Good morning, Your Honor. If it pleases the Court, I represent the City of Harvey on this appeal, who's obviously the appellant. There are really three aspects to this appeal. The first one could take care of the other two if the Court were to agree with us. And that is that we really have here an issue of two judgments, each essentially claiming to be final for the same period of time and for related work. After the judgment was entered on the verdict, but while that judgment was going through post-trial motions, motion for new trial, motion for remitter of punitive damages and so forth by a co-defendant, the individual police officer, Robinson moved for fees up to a particular date, and while the process was still proceeding, asked for and got a judgment for those fees. That judgment was then, originally it asked for 11 of 02. In a petition filed about 8/15 of 03, which was reduced to a judgment in approximately August of 04, and then after some additional motion practice completed in about October of 04, and then ultimately went on appeal, was affirmed by this Court. Now, after that affirmance and after that case came down, Robinson asked for additional fees. And I should say at this point that there's absolutely no dispute regarding the fees that were incurred on that appeal. That is not really part of this dispute. But what happened was...
Did you complain in the district court when Robinson's lawyer asked for fees preceding the entry of final judgment?
We did not. We did not for two reasons. One is that the subsequent proceedings were, except perhaps in a minor manner, all, as far as we were concerned, and this is another issue in this case, directed solely to the individual co-defendant because they had to do with punitive damages for which the city was immune. So as far as we were concerned, anything from that point on was of no concern to us. Secondly, we don't feel we have an obligation to run the strategy or in any way direct the other side as to whether they are cutting off future rights, not cutting off future rights. That's up to them and their strategy.
I'm not sure I understand that. I mean, I understand the principle that you don't want to do any favors for your legal adversary.
Right.
But the way in which this system is supposed to work is that fees aren't available until the prevailing party has a judgment in its favor. And until the district court had finished with its work and entered a judgment, Robinson was not a prevailing party. Winning a jury verdict doesn't make one a prevailing party. Only getting final judgment makes one a prevailing party. So the way this is supposed to work is you get a judgment in the district court, then you ask for fees preceding that judgment. And this plainly was not happening here.
That
it's also pretty clear that the first panel that heard the first appeal thought that that's what had happened here. They thought that $500,000 was the cost of the attorney's fees for getting a final judgment. And we now learn that it wasn't remotely that actual cost. So the question I'm asking is, why weren't you saying no fees are available until there's a judgment in Robinson's favor? Because that's the legal requirement. And at that point, and that's in your client's interest. And if you enforce that requirement, we never get this problem.
Well, that is true, Your Honor, except that no one was challenging the compensatory aspect of the underlying case. As I say, as to the city, the case was over. There were no...
No case is over until there is a final judgment. The legal requirement, this is what the Supreme Court has held repeatedly, is that no one is entitled to fees without being a prevailing party, and no one is a prevailing party until the district court has entered its judgment.
Well, the way I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, I don't necessarily disagree with it. The way I would analyze it, though, as we are now, which is either we have to undo the previous judgment because it was an appeal on a non-final judgment, it would have been...
You screwed up the appeal from the real final judgment, which is why the panel dismissed it. The appeal of attorney's fees is distinct from the appeal of the underlying judgment. There's no problem with the finality of the judgment. The problem that gave rise to this appeal was that until there is a final judgment, there is no prevailing party for the purpose of an award of fees.
What I'm saying by judgment is the judgment on the fees. I'm not talking about the substantive judgment. That also came up. That was consolidated. That was ruled upon, and there was an affirmance. If that was not a final judgment for fees, I'm only talking about the fee aspect, Your Honor, then it would have had to be, if anything, an interim grant of fees, but it was never proposed as such or handled as such, and it could only have come up to this court as a collateral order, but that was not the way it came up, nor the way it was ruled upon. So if we view that somehow or other the original fee judgment was not final, then what happened before is now the original affirmance is upset, and we're back to a situation that hasn't yet been appealed or ruled upon. And as I see it today, I would liken it more to a contract where a person has the choice of suing prematurely on a certain amount. It's not a segregated contract. I know there are contracts that where payments come by units, but someone can sue for what on a unitary contract has accrued thus far, gets the judgment, and that, I believe, cuts off his right to come back and say, well, the rest of the contract now I want to collect on. In this situation, they moved for part of their fees. They got a judgment for part of the fees, like part of a contract. They came up. They didn't argue that it wasn't a final judgment. They didn't say that this is not a final judgment for fees. And they stood by it. They got an affirmance. And now, like the person on the unitary contract, they want to come back now and say, oh, by the way, prior to that final judgment that we all litigated and we had an affirmance of, now we want to add more load to that same time period predating that judgment. And that, I think, is now foreclosed by res judicata, which not only bars what was litigated, but also what could have been litigated. And they try to say in answer to this that, well, there's 54.3, which has this elaborate process. Therefore, we couldn't have raised it. But if you look at that rule, it says that on application, the court can amend the scheduling. And remember that between the filing of the original schedule and the entry of the judgment, a year had gone by. There was plenty of time to add the additional fees in. And in most cases, people do come in at the end, and they have a supplemental fee, which is handled rather efficiently. Otherwise, you've got Zeno's arrow that you can never get to the fees that were used to get the fees, and you go on interminably. In this case, they could have asked the court for an extension of or a change in the scheduling. They did not. They were not denied it. They never asked for it. And therefore, it was a possibility that they could have, in fact, put everything together. They weren't forbidden or prevented from doing so, and that, therefore, there's no excuse against the application of res judicata. Now, the second part of our argument is that if res judicata does not apply, then the local rule 54.3D does apply. That required them, at the time that the judgment for fees and the other judgment was entered, when that was finally finished, they could come in within 90 days with a petition for the additional fees. They did not do that. They did not go to the court. They did not ask for an extension or a change in the schedule. They did not present a fee petition within those 90 days, and that therefore they're now time barred. They want to come in and say, well, 3 years later, we can come in. And they argued to the district court, which said that Rule 54.3D does not have a time limit. It's only laches. And she relied on the Guttrell case. Now, the problem with that is that the Guttrell case was decided in 1982, when it is true that the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 54, under which the local rule was promulgated, did not have a time limit. But 11 years later, in 1993, that rule was amended and a time limit was inserted. It was 14 days, or the local court could alter that time period, and in this district it's 90 days. Then this case came up approximately 13 years after that amendment. The district court judge did not recognize that there was this time limit in the rule, relying exclusively on now this outdated case. And I might add that even if laches were the rule, once you have a time period for such things, equity follows the law. It's no longer this balancing and nebulousness. Equity will follow the law. And if whether it's called laches or it's called Rule 54.3D, that time period is 90 days, and they're barred because they did not pursue it. The last point is on punitive damages. If we actually get to a consideration that they weren't barred and that we have to look at the damages. And under those circumstances, the court looked to a decision of this case, which did not actually look at our fact situation. It had quite a different fact situation, so it's not really precedent, and looked to Graham. Now, but did say the right thing, and that is that fees cannot be imposed against an immune party. The problem is the district court didn't recognize that we are immune from punitive damages, which are totally different compensatory damages. If you were to graft the sentence for compensatory damages, the plaintiff is the subject, and the object is to compensate fully that plaintiff for injury, and it's a right. If you look to punitive damages, the subject is the defendant, the object is to punish him without annihilating him, and it's not a right. The plaintiff is a surrogate for the public. So we had a totally segregated part of the case in which the city had no part. And under Graham, since we are not a party to that litigation over punitive damages, we should not have had fees imposed on us. If you look at footnote 13 of that opinion, the court specifically recognizes that local governmental bodies are immune from punitive damages. The whole thrust of that case is that you have to understand the difference between individual liability and governmental liability. And there's a statement there about you can't impose one person's fees on another, and it goes on to say much less a non-party. But in our case, we're the other because we had no dog in that fight. So there should not have been any punitive damages imposed on us. That was the personal and exclusive obligation of the policeman, the individual defendant, Escalante. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Ader. Mr. Levy.
May it please the Court, John Lovey on behalf of the appellee. It was very telling that the appellants were unable to find any case in this jurisdiction or any jurisdiction that has ever supported the view of res judicata to bar a fee petition in this context anywhere. It's never been applied.
No, res judicata is obviously the wrong phrase. It deals with separate litigation. But I think what the defendant was getting at, quite apart from the punitive damages, is the rule that first the plaintiff has to be a prevailing party before you get any fees, and that there should just be one fee award after the plaintiff becomes a prevailing party, unless there's subsequent work, like the appeal. What seems to have happened in this case is the plaintiff split one proceeding into two, and there are two possibilities. Either the whole $505,000 was premature and should have been vacated on appeal, or the first appeal should have been dismissed for want of jurisdiction because it was not a final award. You know, those are two possibilities, but neither seems to cast this in good shape. If we assume that the first appeal was within the court's jurisdiction, that can be true only because the award was final. And if that was a final award, it doesn't seem possible to get more. Right? That's the problem. It doesn't have anything to do with res judicata.
The final judgment in this case was in July of 2002. We filed our petition after the final judgment. That's docket entry 169. So we sought time before the final judgment. And granted, the briefing of the petition took longer than anybody expected, in part because the defendants were asking for more time, in part because the district court was making a lot of efforts to settle the case. But we only sought in that first petition time for the before the final judgment, and we only sought that after final judgment had been entered. So I apologize to Your Honor for not understanding the point, but we did file our fee petition, and the fee petition was granted final judgment.
Look, this may be terminological, but if a post-judgment motion under Rule 50 or Rule 59 is filed, what Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4A says is that suspends the finality of the judgment. It's no longer a final decision. It becomes a final decision again only after the district court has disposed of those motions. So what happened was that there was this thing in 2002. There are then post-judgment motions, and under Rule 4, it's no longer a final decision. At this point, with a non-final decision, the fees petition is filed and awarded, and then the decision becomes final, and now you're here seeking fees for a period before this decision became final, at least as Rule 4A understands finality.
I guess
that's where it seems to me the problem is arising.
Certainly by acquiescence, because neither side had any problem argued that it was premature. But wouldn't it have been by the time that the case got on appeal, it was final? So everything was final by the time the court got it.
Yeah, well, the decision on the merits was final, but it certainly doesn't look like the award of fees was final.
Well, you know, in the fees context, sometimes
this
fees
request
goes,
and the award in the district court is for attorney's fees that were incurred before the district court's decision became final.
Isn't it true, though, Your Honor, that fees often proceeds on a different track? You know, fees, you can have no jurisdiction on the merits, and we could still be talking about fees. At best, what Your Honor identified is that perhaps unbeknownst to both our parties, both the parties, the appellate court should not have been considering their fee appeal. And
yeah, but the problem is that the Court of Appeals did consider it. Both parties represented to the Court of Appeals, as they are required to do by Circuit Rule 30, that the appeal in 2005 was from a final decision of the district court. But your argument now is that it was not from a final decision of the district court, but the Court of Appeals' decision, resolving it on the merits, is permissible only if it was a final decision.
Well, Your Honor, it was final, then we have to look at what was final vis-a-vis. It was final vis-a-vis the fees that were presented to the court, and the district court said the only...
Goodness. But, you know, back to Mr. Ader's analogy, which I think in this respect is a good one. That's like saying the first appeal is from the damages we incurred before a particular date, and now we want an appeal on the damages we incurred after that date. True, they could have been quantified earlier, but we can keep doing this. And, of course, that...
Well,
not final is not allowed.
Your Honor, Judge Lefkow concluded that we couldn't have sought them before because the meet and confer process hadn't yet been concluded. And in the way she put it, those weren't ripe for adjudication. So, yes, I agree with you that the key premise in their argument is we could have sought some segment of these fees, but that is false. That premise is incorrect. Judge Lefkow said you couldn't have sought fees for which you had not yet engaged in the meet and confer process. So even if it was final,
it's only final with respect to what
she considered.
That's kind of like saying we can come back for a second helping of damages in a civil case. We couldn't have sought them earlier because we failed to serve our discovery requests. There is no problem in following the rule 54. You could have filed within the required time after the district court's judgment became final, a request for all of the fees incurred before the judgment became final. There's no problem in following that procedure. Nothing prevented you from doing it. You chose not to do it. That's true. You chose not to request a conference with them about it, but nothing prevented you from doing it.
Nothing prevented them from treating it as if it was going to be treated the way Your Honor's identified. In other words, they didn't provide us their time. We're supposed to meet and confer and exchange time. Both parties operated under the assumption that the time Judge Lefkow was going to adjudicate was the time for which we had exchanged time, which was 2002 before final judgment. Both sides didn't exchange time. We sent them a letter. It's referenced in our brief where clearly we're going to come back for more time, and there's going to be one fee petition. And Judge Lefkow correctly said there was no undue delay, and it was reasonable because we're going to do this all at once. Plaintiff might lose the appeal, and if plaintiff loses the appeal, it's moot. Plaintiff might win the appeal, in which case there's going to be another fee petition.
Here for the argument in the first case.
Yes, sir.
Where we raised a question about appellate jurisdiction because the parties attempted to proceed in just that way. India Brewing might have lost the appeal, and in that event, the other side didn't want to pursue its counterclaim. What they wanted to do was reserve the counterclaim for decision if India Brewing won the appeal. And you heard the questions from the panel. That just is impermissible. The parties and the district judge might want to split the appeal, do some things now, and we'll save the work and not do it unless the Court of Appeals first hands down decision X. That's just an effort to engineer a way around the final decision rule. And you're now saying, gee, we all wanted to evade the final decision rule.
Your
so
Honor,
that's okay.
The premise in the position is that we could have sought that time. And Your Honor has assumed that, but we have to examine it more closely because Judge Lefkow said, we could not. That was not part of my decision. The time that had not yet been meet and conferred, the way she put it in her opinion was, there's an elaborate meet and confer process. The only time which I can adjudicate is the time which has already been met and conferred.
There is no rule a district court can issue that will avoid the final decision rule on appeal. The district court says, I've just decided as a matter of local practice not to fully resolve or not to fully quantify awards and to do that only after the Court of Appeals has decided. That's an invalid rule. It prevents appeal of the decision. It is just not something a judge can do no matter how much she wants it. Now, the problem that we're now in is nobody alerted this court to the fact that the appeal back in 2005 was from a non-final decision.
Correct, Your Honor.
So you've created the very thing that we have finality for. You're coming back on an appeal for fees for the same time period that's already been adjudicated.
Well, we didn't appeal last time, and we didn't appeal this time. But we are coming back on an appeal on fees that Judge Lefkow granted on a time period which was not adjudicated the first time, which Judge Lefkow anticipated and expected the parties to do this in two pieces. You know, and she said, the plaintiff was not unreasonable. I mean, we defer to the district court.
The problem is, you should have alerted the Court of Appeals last time around to the fact that the city was appealing from a non-final decision. They had one problem with their appeal on the merits. They had a second problem with their appeal on the attorney's fees, which was that they hadn't been fully quantified. But you chose to represent, I looked at your brief. Your brief says their jurisdictional statement about the attorney's fees issue is complete and correct. And it's complete and correct only if it's a final decision. You represented that to the Court of Appeals the last time.
And, Your Honor, we have to accept that. We represented that it was final. Now, the question becomes final as to what? And the district court said it was final as to what I considered. Fees is not like damages. It is what I considered. And the district court said it was not. The fees you are now seeking after the meet and confer period, I couldn't have decided. It was not before me. I had no jurisdiction to have decided.
Only because you didn't file an application.
It was only before us because the parties, by acquiescence, agreed together to defer because there was going to be another fee petition, and the district court has now said in her discretion that that was the proper way to have gone.
Okay.
Yes, we could have sought those fees, but by acquiescence of both sides, we said we're not going to.
Yeah, jurisdictional representations have consequences. You represented to the appeal to the court first time that that was a final award.
I understand, and that makes begs the question of final as to what. And Judge Lefkow said it is final vis-a-vis the fees that I had jurisdiction to rule on, that I could have ruled on. But this question of other fees, I couldn't have decided. And she cites what she calls the elaborate meet and confer process. She says even if I had wanted to rule on those fees, it is not yet ripe. And that raises the question that we raise, which is we would have had to daily submit timesheets as we're working on the appeal.
No, look, come on. One can discuss this without being absurd. When the judgment becomes final in the district court, under Rule 54, you have something like 45 days to file a fee petition, right? You don't do it every day. You do it within a certain time after the final decision.
Well, my understanding is, Your Honor, that as of the final decision, any time that hadn't been claimed could be caught up in a res judicata barred because the final decision now is the cutoff. If the final decision is
nothing to do with this.
If the final decision is not the cutoff, then why isn't it what Judge Lefkow said, which is, I will allow you to seek that time at another time? And in other words, Judge Lefkow, we are stuck with our certification that there was jurisdiction in this court for everything Judge Lefkow ruled on. But Judge Lefkow said, I did not rule on the slice of fees.
That's why I asked whether you were here for the first case. The first case was final with respect to everything the district court had ruled on. But the parties had withheld from the district judge the counterclaim. We said, and we have said more times than you can count, that finality is not a measure of just what did the parties submit to the district judge. It's a matter of, is the dispute concluded? This dispute was not concluded. The parties had submitted only part of the dispute, but until the dispute is concluded, it's not final.
Well, that's where we disagree. We think it was concluded as to the fees which were ripe for adjudication. As to the fees that were not ripe for adjudication, it wasn't. And, Your Honor, this covers obviously the middle slice between the final judgment and the adjudication. They concede we'd be entitled to fees for the appeal. They concede we'd be entitled to fees.
This didn't go back to Judge Lefkow until after the appeal was affirmed.
Correct, Your Honor.
So she kind of started over again what Judge Plunkett had already decided.
No. She was actually there part of the time she was there is when she said, let's have settlement conferences, when she was granting their motions to push it back. It was only then that she recused.
The appeal.
I forget if because they're on separate tracks, fees and appeals. But the meet and confer started under Judge Lefkow, Your Honor. It was Judge Plunkett inherited the fully briefed fee petition. The fee petition was briefed under Judge Lefkow. So, what we're talking about is the middle slice between 2002 and 2004. The defendants don't deny that we're entitled to go back after fees after the appeal. And, I think we have identified the dispute. I think Your Honor has identified that if we could have sought the fees, then our jurisdictional certification is going to create a problem for us. But I urge this court to conclude otherwise. Judge Lefkow said you couldn't have sought those fees because they weren't ripe, because both parties were treating that as an issue that was going to be deferred. Both parties were going to wait and meet and confer it later.
What about the fees clearly attributed to the punitive damages?
Your Honor, they weren't clearly attributed to the punitive damages. That is a characterization by them. Judge Lefkow said, in the first instance, they weren't purely attributed to punitive damages. They were intertwined with other things. Harvey, and they're now saying it's a dispute just between us and Escalante. Harvey paid its lawyers to attend the same proceedings. This wasn't just about punitive damages. They've made a straw man trying to pretend it was just about punitive damages. Judge Lefkow said it was not just about punitive damages. And it was even if you accept their characterization, it was about collection. And Harvey did not pony up the compensatory damages. So this court's clear that collection efforts are compensable. And they say, well, you should have been patient. We didn't have to be patient. So even that small slice that could be attributed to purely punitive collection, which we don't concede, even that was fairly characterized as also collection generally. And frankly, Judge Lefkow had extreme discretion to say, I'm not going to allocate it. I'm going to make it joint and several. And in Judge Lefkow's on the front line, she said, I don't think it's fair to attribute this just to Escalante. I think it should be attributed to Harvey. And this court should defer to that exercise of discretion. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm.
I'm out of time. If there's any other questions.
Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further?
Yes. Originally, I was going to forego rebuttal, but there were three comments made at the end that I feel I must respond to. First of all, there was absolutely no acquiescence as to the division. We handled that in our brief, and I won't try to argue it now, but I do want to call your attention that we're not sitting here quietly agreeing that there was any sort of acquiescence. Secondly, as far as the attorneys for Harvey participating or being present at these various court dates, if you look at the dates that they've listed on one of the pages, they have extensive two or three lines of dates on one of the pages of their appellee's brief, and you go through the record where their own listing is there and our evidence that we put in is there, you will see that only one date was a court date, and that was 2/26, I think it was 04, but it was 2/26, and it was on that date. There was 3/4 of an hour charged by us to attend and watch while Escalante, I think it was, asked for a stay on the judgment against him. So it's not true that we participated or were involved. We reviewed, we followed the documents to report to our client, monitored, I guess is the word, but we didn't in any way participate or have a dog in that fight. As far as the fees for collection, there was only $25,000 in compensatory. It was paid immediately upon the affirmance from the appellate court. There is an obligation on a party who is seeking fees to be reasonable.
Okay. The case will be taken under advisement.